Congressman Jim Banks and President Trump say schools must reopen or else. The iRead will be offered this fall, plus a court challenge over barriers to Election Day lawsuits and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 10th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, President Trump threatened to withhold federal funding from any schools that don't reopen to in-person classes this fall. That follows an Indiana congressman who introduced a bill to do the same. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle has more.
During a recent TV appearance, Republican Representative Jim Banks said the reason for his legislation is that the wide-scale remote learning has not been effective.
And we have a whole generation of kids that we're leaving behind if we don't get them back in the classroom in the fall.
The bill Banks co-authored would deny K-12 and colleges federal funds if they don't reopen by September 8th. Indiana State Teachers Association President Keith Gamble says the proposal is irresponsible. He says state and local leaders should decide when to open.
We are listening to those who have degreed, who have studied health and seeking their advice. And many are saying that we have to be prepared for a second wave.
Political observers say the bill is unlikely to become law.
Should schools be forced to reopen for in-person instruction? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Now, before we get to this topic, I want to just say one word up top. Slightly before we started taping the show today, we found out that the Indiana Republican Party delegates had selected Todd Rokita, the former Secretary of State and Congressman, as their nominee for Attorney General, ousting incumbent Curtis Hill. That is obviously a big topic. It happened very late today, and so we will talk a lot more about that on next week's program. As for this week's show, Ann Delaney, studies have shown that the virtual learning that took place at the end of the last school year wasn't really that effective, and in fact, significantly less effective in some studies. So should schools have to reopen like that?
Well, let's start out by saying that Donald Trump and Jim Banks were part of the Republican Party who said virtual learning, homeschooling, and all was the way to go, remember? And now they're admitting it's a failure. But the problem with this whole analysis here is that the money that the federal government gives to schools is from Title I, which goes to poor schools, which are precisely those schools that are least able to adapt to the coronavirus. They don't have the space, they don't have the facilities, they don't have all that they need to sanitize and make it safe for those children. So I think the two of them who are wading in waters they have no business being should just stay out of it and maybe go back to funding traditional education where 93% of the students in our state go.
Mike O'Brien, given the limitations that we know of virtual learning that we experience, that many schools experience at the end of this past school year, should schools have to reopen, at least in part, to in-person classes?
Well, I think most of our plan on it, I think we all can agree that the most effective way to for these kids to learn is by being present in the classroom. That's not to say we should shut off other alternatives for people that for students that are in poor performing districts and need a virtual option through that charter the charter policies and school choice policies we've advocated for that Ann just addressed. But look, I think ideally we follow the plan that Governor Holcomb's got us on, which is we are reacting to data at the local level and on the ground and responding to that. I think schools are going to be better prepared for the fall semester from a virtual standpoint. Some are coming up with hybrid approaches or partial days, but I think they'll be better prepared. But I also don't think we should be penalizing schools to the degree that has been suggested with federal funding for decisions that are out of their hands. No more than businesses have been penalized for having to shut down when the government told them to do that. The schools are largely may not be making these decisions and shouldn't be penalized to that degree for it.
Yeah, from what we know is that schools are making these decisions about reopening with their local health departments. And Nikki Kelly, the President Trump part of it aside, Jim Banks has been pretty outspoken about this for weeks now. Is it for him a very popular thing to say?
Well, it's certainly not popular among teachers, I mean, and educators. I mean, I don't know when we've gone from working together and collaborating for a safe environment for kids to just straight threatening schools. You know, I don't think that's the best act to take. Now, I'll be clear, I think it's a really long shot that that was passed, but still, it puts teachers immediately and schools immediately on the defensive.
Yeah. John Schwanes, we heard Eric Weddle in his report say political observers don't expect the Banks bill to become law. But that was written and voiced before President Trump this week came out and said essentially the same thing, which is that schools should be punished if they don't reopen. Does that make such a measure any more likely to become law?
I don't think the chances necessarily are any better now that the president has taken his stand. I'm not sure. It seems that it would be a pretty large sledgehammer for an issue that requires a lot more nuance. I'm a fan of traditional instruction. I always did better in the classroom to the extent it was relative, you know, better than I would have otherwise. Did not great, but so I do think that's the right approach. However, I find the most interesting debate here to be the political or philosophical one, which is the people advocating a federal mandate that schools do X, Y, and Z are the very people who have for decades said that it's a matter of local. Schools are best governed at the local level. You know, school boards know their schools better than anyone else. They're the ones who should determine what tests should be administered and how teachers should be compensated. And at the very least, let's do it at the state level, they would say, if not the local level. So this is quite a departure philosophically, it seems to me, aside from just the public health question of are kids going to be at risk by being in the classroom. Yeah.
It's amazing how those little currents can shift, isn't it?
Local control when it's convenient. That's the watchword of all politicians.
Well, we like it.
All right. Well, speaking of schools, they can administer the state's iRead3 test this fall. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay explains to us the state's top school official disagrees with the State Board of Education's decision to allow schools to use it.
Board members supporting the move say it can help schools gauge learning losses caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But the state's top school official, Jennifer McCormick, says the test isn't designed for that, and schools have other options.
We have a lot of resources available that can give us the data we're looking for that baseline that we already spend quite a bit of money on.
Under McCormick's leadership, the State Department of Education has recommended getting rid of the test altogether and using existing state exams to save schools time and money. According to McCormick, it costs the state about $300,000 a year to administer the iRead.
Mike O'Brien, the exam is just optional in 2020, but given everything that's going on, including the discussion we just had, should it really be offered at all this year?
Well, that's for a local school district to decide. I mean, schools across the board are trying to assess what the impact has been of the last two or 2.5 months of the school year that they had to pivot very rapidly to. And so it's understandable that there's a learning gap there. The state, the comments of the contract and what it costs to administer this test is relevant because if it's a product we've already purchased and a resource that we already have, why not make it available to schools as an option to, if they like that test or understand that it will help give them an additional window into what the impact of that last quarter of school was and how to help close that skills gap as the education gap that resulted as the school year begins, then there's no reason to not offer it.
And Delaney, if you were running a local school corporation, would you want to offer the test this year?
No, I wouldn't. And, you know, their obsession with tests never stops. It doesn't matter how bad it is. It doesn't matter that they've just rejected it. They want to do it again. My understanding of this test is that it's administered in the lower grades of elementary school to judge reading ability. It is not going to do what they say it's going to do, but they feel like they have to test. It doesn't matter whether the test does anything. It doesn't matter whether the test costs, whatever it costs. It doesn't matter if they make up their own. We need a governor who's going to dictate education policy, okay? We don't need a state board of education that wants to flounder around made up of a lot of amateurs. The governor should take responsibility for this. He should say it shouldn't be offered.
John Schwanes, we heard a lot of folks, or we've heard over the last year or so, we've talked about the General Assembly and the State Board of Education holding schools harmless for the other big standardized tests that a lot of grades take. And given everything that's going on with the pandemic and will be for the foreseeable future, at least for the next school year, is there going to be a whole lot of holding harmless when it comes to test results over the next however long?
Oh, I would imagine, because the alternative is pretty ugly and pretty bleak, I would think, when you have entire schools and entire districts, for that matter, that probably have abysmal scores, not through the fault of students, not through the fault of teachers or administrators, but simply the misfortune of having dealt with an unprecedented health crisis. So I think it would be probably silly to try to hold everybody accountable. I guess you could argue, since we're all in the same boat and every district is facing the same health challenges, if you grade it on a curve, so to speak, I guess that's one way to do it. You'd still have, in theory, at least some schools faring better than others. But even that's problematic because not everybody has the same kind of internet access, the same platforms for virtual learning. So that probably wouldn't, that would be called into question as well.
Nikki, Kelly, as you're, if you're a school who's evaluating whether or not to give this test, we've heard long before, and this is not unique to Indiana, about the stress of these standardized tests on teachers and on students. So in a school year that I imagine will be rather stressful for a lot of other reasons, would that lend you to side on err on the side of maybe we just don't need to do it this year?
I would have to be an expert far more than I am to understand whether they could get any helpful results from that. I mean, one test on one grade, I don't think is a massive, you know, big deal. But if they don't feel that they can get any helpful data, then obviously there's no use to exclude that.
All right, well, advocacy groups are suing Indiana over a state law that prevents voters from asking a court to extend polling place hours on Election Day when there are problems voting.
The 2019 law says only county election boards, by unanimous vote, can go to court to request extended polling hours on Election Day. Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Senior Counsel Ami Gandhi says Hoosier voters that face problems at their polling place should have the right to ask courts for help.
Eligible voters, and particularly voters of color, are at risk of disenfranchisement.
Common Cause Indiana's Julia Vaughn says the state law presents another problem. It restricts a court from deciding what polling place problems should prompt extended voting hours.
Making the closure or failure to open on time of a polling place the only legitimate reason to extend voting hours.
Vaughn says there are cases from 2020 in Georgia and Kentucky where courts extended polling hours based on citizen lawsuits that show why Indiana's law could unfairly block Hoosiers from voting.
Sean Schwannis, in your mind, is there a good justification for only allowing a unanimous election board to file suit to extend polling hours?
I guess if I were running elections, I would say, oh, it makes all the sense in the world because I want to rule out any sort of potential, any contingency that any curveballs. But that practical consideration notwithstanding, from a legal standpoint, it seems that it deprives individuals of a right that is unquestionable or has been in the past, which is if you have standing in a suit and in potential litigation, you have the right to seek a remedy in the courts. I mean, that's sort of fundamental. And so the notion that doesn't matter whether you have standing or not, and I think we can all stipulate that voters who are affected by problems at the polls would have standing, I would think. So that's not the hurdle. But the fact that they simply then must be silenced and not even have their proverbial day in court, I think, is constitutionally problematic, really.
Nikki, is perhaps the biggest issue here that not only are you restricting anyone but a county election board, but it has to be by unanimous vote?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hurdle that no one's going to be able to get, let's be honest about it. And I haven't heard any good reason to suddenly shut users out of this process. I don't think it's been abused in any way. I think it's really serious. So I haven't really seen a good reason for this change.
This is something that went into effect in a massive election bill in 2019 that I confess I didn't notice this provision. But Mike O'Brien, the General Assembly obviously isn't going to come back and review this before the 2020 election. So is this something that you hope the court gets rid of, or is this a rule that should be in place?
Well, I think the county election boards, because of how they're made up by both political parties and in conjunction with the county election office, are probably in the best situation to understand when it's appropriate, when it's not, to extend or to request that hours be extended. And remember, the unanimity policy is largely in place to protect the minority party in those counties, because it doesn't let the majority run roughshod. So, for example, when I was Hendricks County GOP chairman, we wanted to go to vote centers. Well, I had to go to the Democratic Party chairwoman, and I had to go to the Democratic Party Central Committee and make my case for it so they could vote and have their election board appointees support that. And so that's the kind of collaboration it can provide. I'm not saying it always does that. And there's plenty of examples where the minority party is blocking the majority party in the county or vice versa. But it's better than a majority rules party, because then the majority party in that county is going to win.
And Delaney, I'm guessing you disagree with some of what Mike just said.
Oh, my gosh. This is a blatant attempt on the part of the Republicans to decrease voter turnout. Just like not automatically, like Carl Hucker and the governor aren't saying we can all vote absentee without a reason this November. It's the same thing. To give you a perfect example of what happened with this in the mayoral election in Delaware County, two of the polling places that run by the Republican clerk could not open. They wanted to extend the hours. It took them 7 hours to get the election board together to find a judge, 7 hours out of the 12 hours that the polls were open. This is designed to repress the vote. It's deliberately done like that, just like the ability to vote by mail is being restricted by the Republicans. It's not accidental, and it has nothing to do with voting fraud.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. Now, this week's question needs just a little bit of explanation. On the governor's press conference this week, a national news reporter called in to ask a question and multiple times referred to the residents of Indiana as Indianans, which grated on many an ear. And so that there was a bit of a discussion that occurred after that online, prompted in part by yours truly, as to what residents of Indiana should be referred to as. So we wanted to put it to you, our IWIR audience. What should residents of Indiana be referred to as? Indianans or Hoosiers? Last week's question, we asked you if more people would wear masks if mask wearing were mandatory, as it now is, for instance, in Marion County. 81% of you said yes, just 19% said no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, U.S. Senator Todd Young says he wants the next federal government relief package for COVID-19 to be targeted at those who need help most. Young is critical of the package passed by the U.S. House, a $3 trillion proposal dubbed the HEROES Act.
Legislation includes another direct payment to Americans, hazard pay for essential workers, more money to boost COVID testing, and relief for state and local governments. Young says Congress needs to evaluate the economic picture and more finely target its relief before passing another round of funding.
We still have a lot of underutilized resources, including money in the Paycheck Protection Program, that have not yet been drawn down.
Indiana, like many other states, has been asking for help to fill a significant hole in its budget from lost revenue due to COVID-19, but Congress barred them from using previous federal relief money to do so. Young has said he doesn't want to bail out states, but is starting to change that tune.
I think some measure of flexibility is going to be required and would be appropriate as we appropriate all these monies so that Indiana will be able to fill some gaps with some of these federal monies.
The Republican lawmaker says he doesn't know if the next relief package will include another round of stimulus checks.
Nikki Kelly, is there a way for Todd Young to stay firm on his commitment to not bailing out states that he says don't deserve it, while also providing the help that Indiana needs?
Probably not. And you know, it's a big concern when you consider Indiana's finances. We're, quote, the envy of the nation. We acted responsibly. We had a very large surplus that has helped, and we're still struggling. So I can't imagine some other states who didn't do all those things, and they definitely need bailout. But you can't call it a bailout for one and not a bailout for another.
John Schwanes, we already see Todd Young starting to say, well, we need to have some flexibility or something like that. Is that an acknowledgement that to help one, we've got to help all?
I think that he's moving in that direction. It's when you start trying to put, various requirements on the receipt of these funds, it gets pretty difficult, and it slows down the distribution, the disbursement of funds. And what obviously I think the experts, both in terms of the public health recovery aspect of this and the economic recovery aspect of this, is get lots of money to lots of people as fast as possible. Yeah. And if that means that some people are, able to squirrel away some money or buy an extra nice TV set, that's the price that we pay.
And Delaney, Young talked about looking at the full economic picture and saying, okay, who do we need to help the most? That's where our next round of relief should go to. Is that the right strategy?
Well, it's the right strategy. It just depends on who you define as who you want to help. I mean, the last time around, if you rented from a Trump entity, you got money. If you represented him, you got money. If you lobbied for him, you got money. If you were part of the son-in-law's operation, you got money. Or Elaine Chao's operation, you got money. I mean, yeah, we need to look at where it's targeted, but we also have to recognize the fact that as Nikki pointed out, all states are hurting. Revenue is way down. Their attempt to punish Illinois, which is what this was all about, because they thought they were too generous with state pensions, has got to go. I mean, either we make the money available to the states, all of whom need it, or we watch as the bottom drops out. We're sitting on over $2 billion, and we're telling people we can't pay teachers because they want to go after Illinois. It's crazy. So it's good that Young is changing his position. They all need to change their position.
Mike O'Brien, one part of this is we don't know whether the next relief package will include another round of direct payments to Americans, the so-called stimulus checks that most, if not all of us, got a little while ago. Should the next package include that, or do we not know yet?
Well, I think it should. I think the White House agrees that it should. I think it should be but I agree with Todd Young, too, that we need to start focusing on where is the need and test it from that standpoint, because Ann's not wrong. There shouldn't be people that don't need this money, but it's available to them, so they go and get it just to take advantage of it, because they don't think the federal government's going to be checking on the back. And I think what may change this conversation in the next week or 10 days, we have a giant tax deadline coming up. And we have a lot of small businesses that are going to owe 2019 taxes and two quarters worth of taxes within a very short time period.
Yeah. Well, in light of several sports franchises and other organizations exploring changing names associated with Native American imagery and, in some cases, stereotypes, Governor Eric Holcomb this week said he's not thought about changing the name of Indiana.
Holcomb was asked in his latest press conference whether he'd consider a change to names like Indiana and Indianapolis in light of new conversations about showing respect to Native Americans. He said, though, he's spoken with Native American friends about their shared past and heritage.
And how we can do a better job, we being myself, this administration, how we can do a better job sharing the story of Indiana, sharing the story of who we are as a people, a very diverse people. And to be able to celebrate our successes, to be able to acknowledge our shortcomings and deal with them.
Ann Delaney, is changing Indiana's name a realistic idea?
No, and the answer should have been no, unequivocally. I mean, the idea, I have no problem with talking about our heritage, but a couple of years ago, there was a bill to recognize tribal courts in Indiana, which passed unanimously out of the House to not get a hearing in the Republican-controlled Senate. I mean, we need to do more of those kinds of things, but changing the name is totally unrealistic. And frankly, that answer that the governor gave would have been worthy of Bill Hudnut's best sermons. He said nothing in the course of that. He should have just said no.
Well, I'm sure that Ann, I'm not sure if Ann knows this, but that opinion is shared by folks on right-wing radio this week here in Indiana who were pretty upset that Holcomb didn't just say no. So Mike O'Brien, are you a little surprised that Holcomb didn't just say no?
Well, I think he took the opportunity to reinforce that, we ought to talk about our heritage. I mean, I was with my son's Boy Scout troop in Anderson the other day, and we went through a state park, and we learned about the heritage of the name and the history of the Indian tribes in that part of the state. So, I mean, those are the opportunities we need to take, not change the name to something that might be equally offensive in a year, and we don't know it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, finally, if Indiana were to change its name, what would be a good choice for its new name? Nikki Kelly, I'm going to ask you first.
I have no idea. much like Governor Holcomb, I've not given any thought to that.
Well, a colleague of mine suggested that Indiana could be missing out on a lucrative opportunity here. They should open Indiana's name to naming rights. Exactly. And this colleague of mine suggested that we could all soon be living in Eli Liliana. But that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.